This week on Tapestry, we're off to Orleans County and the town of Lindenville, where Robin Hill Nature Preserve provides shady spots with trees from around the world.
My grandfather, Will Smith, his youngest daughter died of scarlet fever, which is really where Robin Hill came from. This beautiful, incredible place started out as a way of dealing with sorrow.
Then it's all about offering a community cooking space with Savannah Vigrass at the Weber Cafe.
Having to rent out other kitchens is extremely expensive. Being able to give back to the community and give back to people and help them start their own startups is huge.
And we celebrate the Oaks family and their incredible contribution to the Lindenville community. Tell me about your grandfather.
He's the one that purchased the original land in Lindenville in 1919. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he was doing some tomatoes, cucumbers, but mostly chickens.
That's coming up on Tapestry right after this.
Compact Science is your gateway to the science of everything in our region. Join host Sarah Jane Gomlick-Green and investigate the geology of Niagara Falls, discover the chemistry in sponge candy, and learn how density affects lake effect snow. Watch Compact Science on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
From in-depth reporting to musical masterpieces, dramas, and mysteries to local bands, Buffalo Toronto Public Media delivers it all. Stay informed, be inspired, and join us. This is Public Media.
Welcome to Tapestry. I'm your host, Lynn Bader. As we drive up to Robin Hill Nature Preserve, a literal robin spreads its wings ahead. A good sign. Waiting at the end of the long driveway is Doug Pratt, the grandson of William and Mary Smith, eager to take us on a tour and share his family story with us.
This is one of the more interesting trees. This big larch has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 trunks.
That is incredibly interesting because it looks like it's 7 separate trees.
I know, isn't that nifty?
Yeah.
The 45-acre preserve is free and open to the public and features trees and shrubs from around the world.
This tree right in front of
Doug,
us.
Doug, it was your grandfather, your grandparents, who built the home on this land and really have left quite the legacy.
Yeah, I'm still a little awed by it. But of course, I grew up here, so I was too busy being a dumb kid. I didn't realize how special it was until I went somewhere else and came back.
Tell me about your grandparents.
Yeah, my grandfather, Will Smith, he owned the canning factory in town and packed applesauce. In fact, he had about 60 patents for different machinery that he and his son George developed for packing applesauce and handling fruit. Most of the applesauce that you eat today is made by his process.
See, here I thought we were going to be sitting and talking about trees, which we will be. We will definitely get to that.
But that was the way he made a living, and he was really a brilliant guy. And his wife, Mary, was his partner in everything that he did. And he had 7 children, and his youngest daughter died of scarlet fever when she was 19, which is really where Robin Hill came from. Because he needed something to do to work out his grief. This beautiful, incredible place started out as a way of dealing with sorrow. But I wanted to tell you about the house because they started building this house in 1948. It's the very last of the Medina sandstone. They went to 4 different quarries that were closed and picked up as much stone as they could. Those pillars at the entrance where you drove in, that was Uncle George teaching himself to cut the stone.
Interesting.
So he did all of the stonework on the outside, and he did all of the woodwork on the inside. George was an amazing craftsman. In fact, two years ago, we made the Medina Sandstone Hall of Fame.
Your grandparents wanted to really make this a space that was open to the public so that people could come and enjoy what is here and what they built.
Granddad always said, anybody who respects the place is welcome here. And of course, we feel the same way. And Granddad loved to show people around and loved to welcome people here.
Has there ever been any research done on the grounds of the different trees?
Yeah. In fact, I did some work with the University of Buffalo Arboretum Department and a couple of their grad students, we found about 300 different varieties of trees that he planted here, and I've been working through the files that he kept to help sort of track those down.
And keep them identified.
Yeah, I'm doing some work with Cornell at the moment, mm-hmm. and we're hoping to bring some more people in here. I would love, if anybody is listening to this who has a friend of a friend who could make a graduate project or something connected with a college where they could make use of a 45-acre arboretum, call me.
Oh my goodness.
We would love to do something like that, because there's all those sorts of stories about the sort of things that Granddad did. Back in the 1930s and 40s, Granddad had some friends who were missionaries in China, and they sent their son back here to Yale to get his degree, and he encountered a fossilized stump of the prehistoric ancestor of the giant redwood, the Metasequoia. And he said, I think I've seen some of these. So they went back to Mongolia, and they found a stand of 6,000-year-old Metasequoia trees. Well, they found five cones that had seeds in them. So to five different people in the United States who were friends of theirs, they sent a cone. I still have the box with the Chinese stamps all over it. And Granddad got a couple of them going, and now we have an 80-foot-tall Metasequoia in Lindenville, New York. It may very well be the oldest one in the Western Hemisphere.
Oh, my goodness.
He planted a California redwood right next to it, and I'll take you out on the golf cart and show it to you when we're moving around.
I would love that.
Hanging on okay?
I'm hanging on. Woo-hoo. Doing all right.
I'm going to introduce you to the redwoods.
Let's do it.
Here they are. The one in the front is the Metasequoia, and the one in the back is a conventional California redwood. And they're both around 70 feet tall. They've done well in upstate New York.
And I love how the different varieties are and the different species are planted relatively close to each other, so you can see.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, and it's interesting because the Metasequoia is deciduous. It loses its needles every year.
Do you have a favorite spot?
Where we were sitting, it comes pretty close to being favorite. Actually, I like getting around with the lawnmower because there's all of these little nooks and crannies. But I don't really have a favorite spot, I don't think.
The whole thing is your favorite.
Yeah.
What does it take to keep a place like this up and to keep it maintained?
Well, 9/10 of it is mowing, but fortunately I love to mow. I have some great help that I can call on when I need it, so we can keep the place looking nice.
Doug, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us today. It is truly a peaceful sanctuary you have here.
Thank you. I still can't believe how blessed I am to live here. I raised my family somewhere else, but maybe you have to go somewhere else and become someone else to appreciate where you're from. And now I've been so fortunate to be able to move back here, and so blessed to be able to live here.
At Robin Hill, you can feel how a family's sorrow became a gift to the community. Next, we head downtown to the Weber Cafe, where chef owner Savannah Vigrass is turning an incubator kitchen into a true community hub and a welcoming space for young people and local makers. That's up next after this snapshot of Lindenville history.
Just outside the village of Lindenville, New York, near the corner of Route 63 and Platten Road, stands a curious local landmark, the Lindenville Shoe Tree. With hundreds of shoes dangling from its branches, sneakers, boots, and even high heels, it's captured the imagination of locals and visitors alike for decades. No one knows exactly when it started, but stories point to the 1980s or earlier. Some say it began with a prank, others claim it marked a rite of passage or honored someone who had passed. What began as a roadside oddity has grown into a folk tradition. Families return to add a shoe when their kids graduate. Travelers toss up a pair to commemorate a visit. And for many, it's simply about being part of something quirky and communal. The tree itself sits on private property, but it's long been respected as a public piece of rural art. and the owners have graciously allowed the tradition to continue. In 2021, the Orleans County Tourism Department even recognized the Shoe Tree as an official destination, helping preserve its legacy. Whether you see it as a symbol of moving on or a monument to small-town charm, the Shoe Tree proves that some roots grow deeper when stories are shared in unexpected places.
From culinary school to Main Street, Savannah Vigrass is creating a place to belong. I sat down with her at the Weber Cafe.
Had you always had a dream of opening your own place?
Yeah, it started probably about 15 years ago. I was just learning basics on food and I just fell in love with it and the creativity behind it. And that pushed me to go to culinary school and just kind of start living that dream out.
So there was a business here before yours. Can you talk to me a little bit about the history of that business and maybe even the renovation of the building?
Robert Smith, he had come home for his mother's birthday, and his mother had owned the Lindy Lounge, which was what the Weber Cafe was years ago, for 18 years.
The Lindy Lounge?
Yes.
That sounds like a happening place.
Yeah. It was a library at one point, and then there was a bar and a diner.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Robert Smith, mm-hmm. He has the means to do something about it then?
He was able to get a grant that was for the renovation of this entire block.
Wow.
So Darlene Hartway opened the Weber Kitchen Collaborative 11 months before I moved in. Their business was based around farm to table and keeping community classes, introducing dietary teachers, and just creating a community hub that people could come to and learn how to cook. And sell their goods if they wanted to. Mm-hmm.
So it seems like the goals that Darlene had set up were really aligned with what you were wanting to do as well. What was the need that you saw and how could you structure your business to help others?
People wanted me to start cooking for them. So okay. I started branching out on my own. Mm-hmm. But having to rent out other kitchens to cook out of is extremely expensive. Mm. And being able to give back to the community and give back to people and help them start their own startups, which is something that I wish would have been available to me mm-hmm. at some point, is huge because there are so many people, there's so many great bakers and cooks and people that are creating the most wonderful things that can't sell it and nobody knows about it.
Because they just don't have a space to bake.
Exactly. Because they don't, well, it's got to, you don't have a licensed kitchen to cook out of.
Gotcha.
And then sell it legally. Mm. So being able to really give that back to them at a low cost and then give them the opportunity to sell their products out of the shop or they can take it to market or wherever they choose to is very self-gratifying.
What is it that you love about cooking?
I love the freedom to experiment with different flavors. Playing with different flavor combinations is probably one of my favorite things to do. So we have a family farm called Stymus Farms. So we source everything locally and try to keep everything as farm to table as we can, especially in the on season. And then we're in the process of working with some local butchers to bring everything, all our meats and locally sourced as well. So trying to keep that farm to table lifestyle and really teaching people where their food comes from. We also offer classes such as food preservation.
I think that that's part of the mystique of it all, too, is you're not just coming here to this cafe to enjoy a sandwich or a bowl of soup, but it's an interactive experience.
Absolutely, it is.
I also noticed that there's apparel. I can buy a shirt. let's talk about some of the other things you have available in this space.
So we have several different vendors in the shop that sell their handmade goods.
Okay.
And everything is made within about a 10-mile radius. So it's very, very local. Mm. Some of them are, in fact, our school students as well, which is really cool because it's kind of teaching them how to be their own entrepreneur and really work themselves. And if they want something, they really have to hit the pavement. And they're all going for it. And it's such a cool thing to see, especially with our younger generations.
Sometimes if you just have that local mentorship.
Yes.
Right? You have that local business owner that's willing to model that for them. That's really all it takes.
Yes.
You're providing young people in Lindenville a space to come and hang out.
They like that there's couches and that there's a cool place that they can just come and relax without necessarily having to go home. And they'll come down here, grab food, they'll study, do their homework. It's nice that you can leave the school grounds and there's somewhere to actually go to.
That's safe.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Welcoming, mm-hmm. accepting.
Talk to me about some of the items that are on your menu.
So we have soups, salads, and sandwiches. And then I do breakfast sandwiches, which are, we have the Clarice and the Minerva. Our lunch sandwiches are the Tom Sawyer and the Gatsby.
I sense a theme with the titles of your sandwiches?
Yes. So all of our sandwiches are named after characters on the banned books list because we're all a little bit rebellious at heart. And those are some of our favorite childhood books. So we thought it would be fun to kind of twist that in, especially with the school being across the street. The teachers get a kick out of it. It helps bring the storybook characters to life, especially when we have those books on our bookshelf.
How has the community supported you and your work?
They have been so very welcoming and so warming, and they love it. And they rave about everything. And that's been so reassuring, I guess, because it lets me know that, okay, I'm doing the right thing. We're on the right track. We're keeping people happy, and it's a good feeling.
Well, they're gonna be key players in your success.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. And that was my stomach that was growling, so I'm ready for some lunch.
Yes, ma'am.
Up next, we meet up with Wendy Wilson and Daryl Oakes of Lynn Oaken Farms with a legacy of apples and Western New York pride. We'll be right back.
Explore the Underground Railroad's final stop. Learn about how the Latine workforce organized to overcome discrimination and follow the timeline of immigration in Western New York.
So remember, history surrounds you and includes you.
Watch Compact History on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
From your morning commute to quiet evenings at home, Buffalo Toronto Public Media is always there with trusted news, inspiring stories, and timeless music. It's your connection to a world of wonder. This is Public Media.
Welcome back to Tapestry. I'm your host, Lynn Bader. Lynn Oaken apples have long been a go-to in my house because buying local means supporting family farms and bringing home something special.
Almost all of these were from the 1800s. Spitzenberg is an apple that probably came over with Dutch settlers to the Hudson Valley and was known and written about in letters by Thomas Jefferson.
As the Oaks family winds down their business after a century, we simply say thank you.
The one next to it is called Ben Davis, and it was grown in the 1920s and 30s. And my father said that this apple was grown primarily because you could pick it, throw it in a 3-bushel barrel, beat the head on and mash it down, roll it into a cold storage in Lindenville, roll it onto a train on the Hojack Railroad, send it to New York City, roll it off the train, roll it onto a boat, send it to London.
Okay.
And it still looked like an apple when they got it out of there. It's not much. Like
to close the episode, we meet siblings Wendy Wilson and Daryl Oakes, grandchildren of founder Leonard Oakes at Lynn Oaken Farms.
Tell me about your grandfather.
He's the one that purchased the original land in Lindenville in 1919. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he was doing some tomatoes, cucumbers, but mostly chickens.
Want me to take off?
Take it from here.
Well, he loved chickens. He took a short course at Cornell University, and he just was really, he liked chickens. And they did pretty well at him until it got into the Depression and then on into World War II.
Okay.
And he couldn't find help to manage and collect the eggs and send them to market. But he had always grown what we would call field crops and then apples and peaches. And we were one of the farms in the area that grew a lot of tart cherries.
Don't forget the two apricot trees that's on the corner.
So. Yeah, the two apricot trees, okay. Excellent.
He passed away in very suddenly when he was 52.
Okay.
In 1951. Our father was in college at the time and came home to try to keep the farm going for at least that season. And then ended up taking the farm over and then gradually transitioning to mostly fruit.
Mostly.
And of that, mostly apples.
I know you didn't know your grandfather, but what was he like? I'm sure you've heard stories.
Well, I can tell you that of the older fellows that I knew that knew him,
yeah,
he said he was one heck of a guy, honest and as nice as the day was long.
Oh.
And our grandmother, who lived on to be almost 101, said the same thing.
Tell me about your grandmother.
Oh, boy.
She was widowed at 41.
Yeah.
She still had two young children at home. She was kind of like the original, you know, quiet feminist. She got her younger two kids through school and went back to college at Geneseo to get her library science degree.
Wow.
And at, let's see, she must have been 55. Ended up being the librarian at our local school until she retired 8 years later.
For yourselves, what was it like growing up in an agricultural community, providing food for your neighbors and really everybody in Western New York?
No, you got to speak to that one first.
They're pointing at each other.
You got to speak to that one first because his story is completely different than mine.
For me, it was fantastic because when I was about 5 years old, my dad always had a garden in the back of the house. And I remember saying to him, Dad, I want to be a farmer someday. And that never changed.
Okay.
And went on to college, ended up with a horticultural degree, and then came back and continued on in the management of the farm, eventually becoming the general manager of the business.
All right.
And I knew exactly what I didn't want to do.
You didn't want to be a
18,
farmer.
At 18, I could not wait to get away from this. I mean, I had big fish to fry. And I went away, went to Spain as an exchange student, went on to school in Michigan, and then ended up in Brazil for a year, Miami for 10 years, and then I'm like, well, you know what? It's time to go back to where everybody knows everybody and a handshake is worth something.
Well, Wendy was being kind. We recruited her, and we recruited her specifically because she'd gained an awful lot of skills that we thought could help grow this business in the future. Our father had just passed away. He had started a small retail program that she took and really made it blossom over the next 20 years.
When you took it over, how have you seen agriculture change?
As far as how agriculture, and specifically apple business, has changed over the years, just quickly, my grandfather planted 40 apple trees to an acre, and it took him 15 years to get those trees into full production. My father planted 90 trees to the acre in the 1950s, and it took about 10 or 12 years to get those into production. I came into the business in the mid-70s. I planted 600 trees to the acre.
Wow.
And they came into production in year 7 or 8. Our son, who's not here today, he came into the business about 20 years after that, and he planted 1,200 trees to the acre. They came into production about year 3 or 4. That's how our business has changed relatively rapidly. But if you think about all the capital and the costs and the labor and the land value that went into ramping up higher and more intense apple production, mm-hmm. and along with it, the quality that we were looking for. Mm. But those trees that my grandfather planted cost 50 cents, and the ones my dad planted cost a couple bucks, and probably mine cost from $6 to $7 until we started growing them ourselves. And then I think the last trees we bought and planted a few years ago were $12 at 1200 to the acre.
Wow.
Tremendously capital intensive.
The real interesting part of the apple business came 2017, 2018. We talk about international markets now with apples. We produce more apples in the United States than the American consumer eats. We did that on purpose because there was a desire for American apples being exported to Asia, mm-hmm. South America,
Europe.
And Europe.
Europe.
And also Israel. But with the tariff wars of 2017, 2018, one of the things that happens when you put a tariff on a product coming into the United States, the other countries are most likely to put a retaliatory tariff on things that they're importing into those countries. And one of the things was apples that they put a tariff on, which made the apples unaffordable for their consumer base.
And
what did that look like for you guys?
Well, all of a sudden we were seeing returns for our apples that was about from the 1980s.
Yes.
In some cases, half of what it would cost us to produce them.
And so ultimately that led to a decision by your family where you've sold off a lot of the land now.
The majority of our farm is or will be sold.
Okay.
And that includes not only the productive facilities of the acreage and the trees, we have a fairly extensive set of buildings dedicated to controlled atmosphere storage. We just couldn't sustain it.
But it truly goes back to the actual commodity pricing of the apples. There was, with the pricing we were receiving,
there was no way out.
There was no way.
Yeah, gotcha.
And with the debt we had incurred, we made the decision as a group, all the ownership at the time, all right, let's exit the business.
But exit the business with...
With our heads held high.
All of our debts are paid.
Yeah, not owing anybody.
Not only are the people that we owed money to, but our employees were well taken care of. And
that's been the hardest part.
So we sat down with all of them individually. I said, this is what's happening. We can promise you a job through October 31st. If you feel like you need to go out and find a job, we will write you the best recommendation we can.
Everybody
single
stayed.
One of them stayed. So... Every time we think of it, we just tear up.
And these are some people who have been here over 30 years.
Well, they're family now, right?
Yeah.
Talk about the impact that this family's had on Lindenville, and then maybe the impact that Lindenville has had on this family.
Well, I think we had good leaders in our family, our parents and grandparents. Back to Eloise, who was Leonard's wife. I think she was the first woman on the school board in town. And both my father and I followed in that position.
I learned not to do that.
Okay.
I took the lessons learned from Lindenville and growing up there, and I've kind of transitioned them into a more statewide and countywide.
Okay.
I served on the Orleans County Board of Health, still treasurer of the Elmwood Bidwell Farmers Market. I'm chairman of the board of the New York Wine and Grape Foundation. And it wasn't necessarily a level of expectation, but we learned by example from our parents that give back.
When you grow up in a place and go to school in a place as small as Lindenville, it's about 1,000 people, it affects you. You become a product of that. And the other thing is, as we end, it's been a tough year for us. And you sense a sense of melancholy, I'm sure. But I don't think it's truly sadness. It's just that... we've come to the end of a cycle, an economic cycle for our little family business. And it would have been nice to see it go on. But economically, it just wasn't there. And so don't feel sorry for us.
One thing I have to remember.
Just come and buy some apples in the fall.
Yeah. One thing I always have to remember is we lasted longer than 99% of family businesses.
I call that a success.
I think so.
Wendy left us with a simple reminder. Buying local matters, and buying New York apples will support New York families. That's a wrap on this episode of Tapestry. What's happening in your town? Have a story to share? We'd love to hear it. Email us at tapestry@btpm.org. Missed an episode? Catch up anytime at btpm.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Tapestry is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. I'm your host, Lynn Bader. Thanks for listening.